You tuned into Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to BYT Radio. My name is Brandon Weatherby. BYT Radio stands for Brightest Young Things. Brightest Young Things is an arts and culture website based out of Washington, D.C., with a presence in New York and Chicago. And we also throw events. We have an event this Friday night at the National Geographic Museum. It's Queens of Egypt. We're throwing a Pride event at the end of the month at the Smithsonian American Art Museum. And we'll be returning with our True Crime Festival this November in Washington, D.C. We just finished our True Crime Festival in New York City, which is the perfect reason to have on filmmaker Ed Zwick with us today. Ed, how are you?
Well, thank you.
You have a brand new film. It's called Trial by Fire.
Yep.
It stars one of the best parts of Twin Peaks, Laura Dern.
And a great young actor named Jack O'Connell.
And unfortunately, or very fortunately, it's an incredibly depressing subject matter. It's about the death penalty.
Yeah.
And I opened up about true crime because it seems that we're having a... This is a weird thing to say into a microphone. It seems like we're having a moment of crime. And your film sort of dives headfirst into that.
Well, you know, it's not just crime. I think the trope is changing in the culture. I think the trope used to be crime and punishment.
Okay.
I think we're interested in crime and innocence.
If yeah.
You think about serial. You think about making of a murder. I think it's actually people are realizing a certain amount of the role of injustice in the system.
Do you, okay, when did you start production on this film? When did this seem like a good idea to do
well,
for you?
Well, I bought the article that David Gran wrote in The New Yorker 9 years ago.
So this is in 2009 then?
Yeah, and so we only began shooting, you know, a year and a half ago.
Do you think that the current presidential administration is the reason why there's this true crime boom right now?
I absolutely do, I think, because you have an unpunished predator at the top of the pyramid.
Who would that be? I'm sorry.
Okay, exactly.
So this is something that no one talks about in their films because it doesn't relate to their films. This predates this. This film is essentially over in 2004?
Yeah, except at the end of the movie when you come to see the Republican candidates talking about the death penalty mm-hmm. and using the death penalty as a political, to try to weaponize it as a means of talking about their stance on crime, it actually does relate.
This is the debate we're referring to is the CNN debate from the NBC debate from 2012. Is that
yeah,
the 2012?
Yeah.
Is the Rick Perry,
yeah.
Mitt Romney debate.
And just parenthetically, you've got a president who took out a full-page ad in the New York Times to try to put the Central Park Five to death long before they were tried and proven innocent, and also recently talked about putting drug dealers to death.
The film does not shy away from things like socioeconomic realities, and
no.
Those are very uncomfortable truths, so let's dive right in.
Okay.
Why do you think that, regardless of how much, maybe this is an unanswerable question, regardless of how much evidence there could be, how much how many new revelations there can be, that unless you make X amount of money, it's most likely never going to change for your life?
Yeah, I mean,
what a horrible question. I apologize.
No, but if you're, it's better to be guilty, to be rich and guilty than mm-hmm. be innocent and poor.
Yeah,
and only with the ability to work that system the way that skilled and sophisticated lawyers who are financed can do, do you have a hope?
I mean, would Amanda Knox be in jail still if she didn't come from that background?
Yes. Yes, I mean, obviously there are remarkable groups, a group like the Innocence Project. There are many people who have taken on, you know, either pro bono cases and have, through the pursuit of evidence and the revealing of exculpatory evidence and DNA and things like that, they have been able to release certain people and proven them innocent. But for them, there would be even more innocent people put to death.
Did working on this project for nearly a decade make you more depressed or make you depressed at all, or the fact that the Innocent Project exists make you feel hopeful that there's a light?
Well, the way to answer that is to talk about a different experience I had. I think when I made a movie called Blood Diamond, and when I first went to Africa, I had a very predictable white liberal response, which is to say a kind of wringing of hands and a sense of being overwhelmed and hopeless. And I was spending a lot of time, and there was a guy there who was helping me as a kind of fixer guide, And he had worked for a lot of NGOs. And he finally turned to me and said, just get over yourself. Get your head out of your ass and realize that, you know, do something. You know, help somebody build a well. Help them talk about a road. You know, create a micro business. Doesn't matter what you do. The minute you start doing anything, no, depression is no longer an issue.
That's wonderful.
It's not about you. And this project, for instance, you look at what this woman did and how she devoted her life to try to help this man, mm-hmm. to create some meaning in a relationship between them. And the 9 years that it's taken us to get this movie made doesn't feel like that because we knew why we were doing it. And if you feel some connection to anything activist, you do it until it's done. It's not about how long it takes.
So this is interesting because the true crime genre, the thing that kind of exploded much, much later than when you started this project, specifically the podcast version of it, seems to be about solving cold cases. Mm-hmm. It seems that there's a reason to work towards something.
Yep.
Where in the past there'd be murder mystery parties and it'd be a fake thing. Now it's unfortunately, maybe fortunately, a real thing. Mm-hmm. So, do you have any feelings about that subset of culture that sort of relates to your film?
Oh, boy, I'll tell you. You know, people are always, probably from the time of the prehistoric cave, they were looking for meaning and explanation, mm-hmm. particularly as pertains to horrible events. So maybe there's something comforting in the search for solutions and meaning. That's part of it. But part of it, I also think, is that there's a sense of overwhelm of the notion of unfairness and injustice that somehow we feel for any number of reasons.
We as the true crime listener, or just we as a human being?
We as a species.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you have any... I'm asking unanswerable questions, and I'd like to apologize. Do you have any feeling that the majority... This is... It can't be proven because we don't know who downloads what, but it seems that based on the True Crime Festival that we have... and the stereotypes surrounding a lot of true crime, it seemed to be predominantly women, like the lead in your film, the woman in your film.
That's a really interesting point to make, because indeed in my experience too, it is women who seem to be fascinated with the genre, mm-hmm. and indeed this woman did the same, and I actually never put those two together.
Well, it's seemingly Laura Dern's character and the majority of these people in the audience are at heart hopeful people that... aren't perpetrators of horrible, horrible crimes, yet are willingly going into this world of horrible, horrible crimes.
Hmm. Whoa. You know, is there some sucker that's, you know what? I'd have to think about that one for a while because it's a really interesting contradiction you're bringing up.
Yeah. Like, usually if you go to a concert, the people on stage are sort of dressed like the people in the crowd and everyone likes the same song. But for this, it's the opposite. Usually it's men and usually they're horrible people.
Yeah.
And the crowd for that is not that.
Is it the same reason that people want to be scared by monster movies? Is it the uses of enchantment that Bettelheim talks about, that the evocation of monsters is oddly comforting, that they exist over there and they're not in your life and they get to be placed in a certain context?
Maybe. We are now answering. Now this sounds like now you sound like a college professor and I sound like a sophomore in my philosophy class, and I'd like to apologize for the listener at home. Could I bring up my favorite true crime case that you might actually know about based on where you're from? So you're from Chicago.
Yeah.
When did you leave Chicago?
Are you going to talk about like Richard Speck or Chuck Percy?
No, this is the least murdery, because there's no murder in it, the least bad true crime story of all time, in my opinion.
Which was?
The Max Headroom incident. Now, Max Headroom incident happened in Chicago over WGN and WTTW, and Channel 9 and Channel 11, and a hacker broke in to the signal over the airwaves, and they broke into Dan Rohn's sports broadcast. Jamal, do you know what I'm talking about? You know about this? Okay, great.
Yeah,
producer. By the way, I'm not just like randomly. So the Max Headroom incident is the biggest unsolved FBI crime of all time. It's technically a true crime. No one's ever been prosecuted, and it's still unsolved. And it's been 31 years at this point.
Wow.
This happened in Chicago, and you had to be watching live TV. Now, not everyone is going to be videotaping the Chicago Bears nightly report on a Sunday night, but This is when VCRs were just starting out and starting out with their big boom. And Doctor Who was airing 2 hours later in WTTW. That is the creepiest hack of all time. That is my favorite piece of true crime. Trivia here.
You know, they then made a television program of Max Headroom, didn't they?
So this was a man. This was during the Max Headroom television program. This is when Max Headroom was so popular. He was the spokesman for New Coke, and you could buy a Max Headroom holiday
mask. That's right, I remember.
Sorry, Halloween mask. So that's what they used. They used a piece of sheet metal to mimic the background of a Max Headroom thing, and a man just talked into a camera while holding a can of Pepsi and referencing Coca-Cola. And it's one of the creepiest and, to me, most heartwarming things, because to me, this is the best true crime story, because literally no one is hurt. There's still a mystery. And because we have no idea who this person looks like, who this person is, it's the, one of the last actual monsters.
There's also the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum heist.
Please continue.
Well, it's the heist of the Isabella Gardner Stewart Museum at Harvard, where they stole, I think it was something like $500 million worth of paintings, and it has never been solved, nor have the paintings ever been recovered.
So that's just interesting, and like there's millions of dollars of lost. Mine created nightmares for children, and there's no money involved. Mine's more of an anarchist for the people problem.
Got it.
The reason why I bring up the Chicago thing, because I know that you're from there, I'm from there as well. Can we talk a little bit about last night?
Sure. Gosh, now you're bringing me back.
If you could have guessed that Rob Lowe would look like how Rob Lowe looks now, would you have guessed that based on his lifestyle in the mid-80s?
Yeah, well, oh boy. His lifestyle in the mid-80s, actually, it wasn't debauched.
Really?
No, not in
Do you know what happened at certain conventions, sir?
Well, I mean, it seemed to have more to do with sex than drugs, and I think sex probably helps your looks in the way that drugs have the opposite effect.
That's clearly the pull quote from this interview.
Jesus.
Let's go back to the film. Let's go back to Trial by Fire. There are some uncomfortable moments in this film that don't have to deal with the premise of the film. Now, the premise of the film is a man is accused of setting his house on fire while his children burn to death. And the reality is that the man was in the house when this happened, but he did not set the fire.
Right.
It was a poorly constructed house.
Yep.
And unfortunately, a man was executed because of...
Yep.
Where his stance in society is.
I hasten to say that lest people run screaming away from the theater, that the movie is also about the development of a remarkable relationship between the character played by Laura Dern and Jack O'Connell.
And that's what I wanted to get to.
Good.
That's where it gets a little uncomfortable, because there are some scenes when the two of them are talking, and you think it's going to go one way, and it's just a little I don't want to say Me Too-y and make it a verb, but it's very stereotypical in a way where, like, maybe you don't go for that type of play, sir. You know what I mean? I guess the question I'm asking is, what was more uncomfortable to shoot? This is a weird question to say. The death of children or an unwelcome come on to an adult that's trying to be a friend?
I think that the death of the incident as it happened, because it's vague and in some way off camera, and you're working with things like fire and stunts, it's technical, and therefore removed. People are the X factor. People have feelings, and people have their eccentricities and can't be predictable as their responses. And so you've got two very sensitive people in a circumstance that evokes all sorts of feelings. And for them, I deliberately kept them apart until we did those scenes, so that what happened on there would be happening for the first time.
Yeah.
And that's why there is that kind of very remarkable chemistry that happens.
Well, Laura Dern is amazing. Yeah. I mean, that's not an issue. Did you watch Twin Peaks: The Return?
You know, I didn't.
Come on.
I'm sorry.
Piece of art.
I've been working, and so I didn't see it. Obviously, I went to film school with David, so I know all the canon of David Lynch, and this is maybe my one omission.
Did you see Star Wars Episode 8?
I saw Laura's part.
There you go. So this is what I'm asking. When you're working with someone Let's be honest here. You have one character. You have one actress that's incredibly well known, that's beloved, and then a man that's not.
Deliberately, frankly, because I think had it been an actor with the persona and baggage that a star might bring, I think you wouldn't have had the same effect of judging him.
Okay.
And because that's the shape of the movie. I think you see him in the beginning, and you do as the jury in Corsicana, Texas did, you judge him. You condemn him. And therefore, you and the audience are complicit to what then happens.
Did you have any hesitancy of dealing with a story in Texas? I know that when you bought the rights, like, it has to stay in Texas. But you are a northerner.
Yeah.
We're from Chicago. We have...
Yeah.
It's very different.
Yeah. I mean,
it's almost a different country.
I've made a couple of movies there. I've spent a lot of time in Texas. But the time that I've spent has been more in the cities. It's been more in Austin or in Dallas or Houston. So I can't profess to have a hardscrabble understanding of West Texas or anything of the sort. On the other hand... I've gone into, you know, Lithuania, and I've gone to Japan and presumed to tell stories about other cultures that are even more remote than mine. So I just made some presumption that I could have some understanding of what went on there.
Do you feel like you were, has there been any pushback?
Well, we were not welcome in Texas, we were told. And when we were looking, talking to the film commission and some very nice people there, they suggested that this would not be the best place to make this movie.
Fun stuff. Fun stuff.
Yep.
Why do this? You don't have to do this.
Well, boy. Listen, when I'm sleepless at night, it's because I'm excited about what I get to do the next day. There hasn't been a single day that I have woken up and said, oh, shit, I have to go to work.
That's nice.
It's the opposite. I started doing this, you know, in the theater, but I was 14 or 15. I think everything that I do is some feeble attempt to recapitulate the feelings that I had at that age and the excitement of it.
So what was the thing that made you get into this field?
Women. No, I'm seriously. It was some feeling about the effect that one can have by holding a mirror up to people or by trying to reach some understanding about the world through its depiction.
This is you don't really have a certain type of film.
No.
You kind of go everywhere.
Well, as I said, I started in the repertory theater, and we would do, Sam Shepard one night and Molière the next, and that kind of promiscuity of taste or interest really keeps me going. I feel challenged. I'm a little bit afraid when I'm doing something new, and that keeps me awake.
So... leading to this film, why, may I ask a very vague question?
Sure. It won't be the first.
Thank you. Why true crime? Why go into the true crime field? Were you even thinking of that, or you just read this story and
I try to be reactive. You have a feeling, you read something and it raises the hair on your arms and it stays with you. And if something stays with you for a day or a night or a year or 9 years, you believe that then it might have the same effect on an audience seeing it for 2 hours. It's about, and the funny thing is, in that process, you deconstruct it and you break it down to its all discrete pieces, and hoping that when you put it all back together, it will have the same effect that it had on you.
Okay.
And it's about, it's, I, maybe this is, I don't know, narcissistic, because it interests me.
Yeah.
And again, what movie do I want to go see that doesn't exist, that I can create, that I might have wanted to go see?
Is it possible to be a filmmaker and not be narcissistic? Because you're creating something that doesn't already have a built-in audience, usually.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You have to lead it through. And this took 9 years.
It's a combination, because obviously you want what you want because you want it, but it's an entirely collaborative medium. And anybody who tells you different is just full of shit. It's about... that it's not just the screenwriter with you, or if you're the writer, and the actors, and the cinematographer, and the editor, and the composer, and the dolly grip who's already ahead of you, where to put the camera. And it is so much about a kind of communal enterprise.
Could I ask I'm going to ask a very vague question that I want a specific answer again.
All right.
What exactly does a producer do? Because you have as many producer credits as you have.
Yeah. I've always tried to be the perfect producer, which is to say, I will do everything or nothing depending on what a director needs. And like when I worked with Steven Soderbergh, when we did Traffic, I was in a position actually in the business that was a little bit more advanced than his in terms of my cutting rights.
Okay.
And I said to him, look, here's the deal. I want the right to say anything that I want about what you're doing, about the script, about the performances, about the cut, anything, and you have the right to do whatever the fuck you want. You just have to listen and then do what you want.
So it seems like you had a right to have a conversation.
That's all I asked. And beyond that, where do you want to have dinner? You know, it's more than that. Obviously, you want to help him get the best people. You want to influence the material as you would have, you know, as a writer or director. But at the end of the day, it is going to be the director who makes those decisions.
So in terms of baseball, are you like a third base coach or are you like a general manager?
I'm actually more of an infielder.
I wanted to
play a sort of shortstop or second base.
Okay.
I wanted to be in the middle of the action. I didn't really want to be a coach.
Are you a baseball fan?
Very much.
What's your team?
Where am I from?
Well, you're from Chicago, but that doesn't necessarily mean anything.
Yeah, I know. I've raised kids in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
My son learned to read by the sports page, but no, I live or die at Wrigley Field.
Now, here's my issue with that. You're a bleeding heart liberal based on your films.
And how do I deal with the Ricketts ownership?
And in addition to that, Addison Russell being back on the field as of yesterday.
Yeah, I heard that they brought him back.
And not winning the World Series without Chapman. So we're horrible people. I've already been okay with the Ricketts ownership because, Jamal, I don't know if you know this.
That's the father and not the son, maybe, right?
No. They're all horrible except Laura Ricketts, the daughter.
Yeah.
Who happens to be a lesbian and who happens to have been Barack Obama's biggest fundraiser in Illinois.
That's right.
Which is the exact opposite of the other half, not the other half, the other like 75% of the family who are almost part of Trump's cabinet, but couldn't get past that. And is now, at one point had the anti-Trump pack in 16, but now is running a pro-Trump pack for 2020. The Cubs are horrible people, but Laura Ricketts negates that. So that's how I've married the Ricketts problem.
So you're zero sum there.
Zero sum there, but on field product. Thank God for Javi. Thank God for Rizzo. They're guys doing great stuff. But then in the same infield, you used to have Daniel Murphy, who is a bigot. Thank God he's no longer with the Cubs. And Addison Russell, who abused his ex-wife. Not a good scenario, Cubs.
Yeah.
Also, we've talked about this on the show before. I'm a big, I don't like super religious people. You got Ben Zobrist, super Christian artist, in your film, in Trial by Fire. One of the things that helps prosecute this man is his love of metal.
Yeah.
Like, come on. Like, that's not good, Chicago Cubs organization. Anyways, this is a serious question. Have you weighed being a Cubs fan in the mid-aughts?
You know, being a Cubs fan has had so much to do with the development of my sensibility as an artist.
Okay.
A kind of tragic sensibility.
Okay.
That it's indelible.
Sure.
And I, whatever I would say or protest, it would be ruling me anyway. So I guess I've not divided it into decades.
That's how we're different. When the Ricketts bought the team and before I knew about Laura, I was like, I'm off. I'm just not watching anymore.
And did you just absent yourself?
Yeah, I was like, I'm just going to root for the White Sox.
For how long?
About a year and a half.
And then you found your way back.
Then I found out about Laura Ricketts. And then I like did some mental gymnastics to work my way around that. And it's that simple. Like, uh-huh. I will go away from a team for a handful. I haven't watched the Blackhawks consistently since the Pitcher Kane stuff happened.
Uh-huh.
So I'm fickle in ways that other sports fans aren't. But I care way more about socioeconomic issues than most any sports fan I know. So it's not, sports is a bad forum to really care about.
No, it's funny. Funny thing is, I care about that. I follow soccer too, and you know when you know Abramovich bought Chelsea, you know I couldn't be a fan, and so I guess I allow it in certain cases.
You didn't grow up with Chelsea. That's
no,
the thing.
That's true. Frank Foer wrote a great book called How Soccer Explains the World.
I would love to read that, and I thank you for your book recommendation.
It's a great book, and it describes all the various teams and what they represent, and how say Real Madrid and Barcelona, one is the Republican team and one is the Franco team.
Oh, I'm super interested in this.
It's a very good
book. I want the baseball equivalent of that.
Yeah, well, that would be interesting, wouldn't it?
Do you,
Yankees and Mets and
here's the thing about that. You live in probably the third best baseball city in the country,
mm-hmm.
and the Dodgers are like kind of easy to root for.
Well, these days particularly.
Yeah, and like their stadium is the fourth best in the country.
Yep.
It's such a good team. But it's like, yeah, they're not the Cubs. they're still the Dodgers. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know. But then again, my son would disagree. My son lives in Silver Lake, and he walked to the park. And
that's pretty great.
That's pretty great.
Did you ever walk? No, you were too far to walk to Wrigley or anything like that.
No, but I was a kid in the burbs, but I would cut school and I'd take the L.
Yeah.
If you left, by about 11:30 or 12, you could get in. And if you left by the seventh inning, you can get back before your mom picked you up at school. And you bought a beer for a guy up in the bleachers, he'd buy one for you.
Yeah. Well, now we've reminisced about things that will never happen again. When was the last time you went to Wrigley?
Gosh, it's been a while. About 2 years.
Okay, so you've seen like the mallization of the place.
Yeah.
I don't know how I feel about that. Like, and I don't think it's an inevitable thing.
How do you feel about being in this hotel? This used to be a bank.
This used to be a church.
Oh, okay.
There's an organ. You can see it. It's behind me. It's in the ceiling. It's great. Well, clearly, as my stance of anti-religious, I'm a fan. Yeah, it's weird. But the difference is kids didn't grow up skipping school to come to a hotel.
That's a good point.
That's the difference. Anyways, Trial by Fire, I'm sure we've sold many tickets, is in theaters. When?
A week from tomorrow, everywhere.
And it stars Laura Dern and?
Jack O'Connell.
But let's focus on Laura Dern because that's going to sell the tickets, baby. Get
there
that money.
Go. All right.
If you're at all interested in the Innocence Project or true crime, you're going to be into this film, which actually in 2019 is an unfortunate good thing to say because there's way too many injustices going on right now. Positivity. Thank you so much for doing this, sir.
This was great. Really fun.
Ladies and gentlemen, we'll be back with the man behind the new Fugazi exhibit. That was Ed Zwick. We'll be right back. That was good. What was that? That was you? Of course. You're going into business for yourself. Will you put yourself on mic for a second?
Hello. Is this working? Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
I can't hear myself back here.
Okay. You know, you're the producer engineer.
Yes. Producer engineer extraordinaire.
But you're also a musician.
I am a musician.
Why is that important?
It's important because music saved my life. Nah. Well, it's important because...
I was trying to plug one event, but you're going really deep.
That's part of the reason why I'm here in this station working, because I've been doing music in different ways, and I have an event coming up at Eaton Hotel this Sunday. It is Mother's Day, but you can come like post-Mother's Day brunch.
I don't know if you know this. Moms like music.
Bring your mom.
There you go.
Bring your mom. You know what I'm saying? It's not too crazy. We're going to have fun, and I think she would like it smooth, like funky, jazzy kind of thing happening. So
not smooth or funky or jazzy, but definitely when it comes to music that saved people's lives. Our guest has a brand new exhibit.
All right.
/ 5-month-old zine about arguably the most important rock and roll band ever to hail from Washington, D.C., Fugazi. Carney, how are you?
Hey, I'm doing pretty well.
Carney, how do I actually pronounce your last name?
Clears.
Clears. I am so glad you said that and not me. Carney Clears. Carney, is Carney your actual name?
Short for Carniel. And I go by Carney.
What is the origin of that name?
It's Hebrew. It would be a name that Israelis could pronounce just fine, but...
Carniel.
Carniel.
It's gorgeous. And I feel so small-minded because I have never heard that name before.
Well, I've never met another Carniel. My parents sort of invented it.
Okay, now I don't feel as bad.
You can just kind of mush words together.
I don't know if you know this, Carney. So. You can do that in any language. Yeah. What does Fugazi mean?
Well, I believe the origin of the band name Fugazi comes from a slang term in the Vietnam War era. So basically, if you're on a mission and it gets Can we curse on the show, by
the
way?
Yes, we can.
All right. So when your mission goes to shit, the acronym that, you know, the slang term that soldiers would use was Fugazi. And I think Ian MacKay heard this in a documentary. And it's an acronym for, fucked up, got ambushed, zipped in. Meaning you got zipped into the body bag.
Now, for the listener at home that's interested in Fugazi, you know anything about Fugazi. For the listener at home that does not know who Fugazi is, they are not a pro-war band.
No.
I want to make that very clear. In fact, you might say they're the opposite of war.
Yeah. So it's an odd enigmatic word that I think Ian just thought was like a beautiful word, and its origin is kind of strange. But
no, Carney just name dropped Ian. Ian is the lead singer, founder, member, guitarist of Fugazi, and he is also a Mount Pleasant resident. And Mount Pleasant is the neighborhood in which the gallery that is hosting your exhibit is in. Do you know if Ian or anyone else in the band has seen your exhibit?
Yeah. I mean, so we had the exhibit in Mount Pleasant pretty intentionally because it, you know, it's about an era of DC where most of the people who are involved in the DIY scene playing in bands, most of them lived in kind of the Mount Pleasant, Columbia Heights area. A lot of the punk houses that were bands were practicing in, playing shows, were right there in Mount Pleasant. At the opening reception, three of the four band members came to the show.
Very cool.
And I got a chance to talk to them a little bit about it. Especially for those that live in the neighborhood, they could just stroll down the street to check it out.
Here's what I like about your show. It's not too intimidating where if you aren't a Fugazi head, that's not a thing people say. If you're not a huge fan of Fugazi, it's still incredibly interesting. And the way you use design to show community is remarkably well done, and it's inspiring. Mm-hmm. Does this make sense?
Sure, yeah.
Am I throwing too many compliments at you? Now I feel weird because there's no question there. So what I love about this is Fugazi from the outside, especially as a guy who was making zines when Fugazi or the Evens were playing those zine conferences, always felt like the other to me. I was one of the few people that did not like the band, not because of what they sounded like, but because of what they represented. Now, usually when people hear Fugazi, they love what they represent. They love that it's $5. They love that it's all ages. They love all these other things. They love like bands on the floor, community type of atmosphere. I didn't like the straight edge part of it.
Sure.
Now, it wasn't like I was like, I want to just be drunk with hardcore kids. Don't like hardcore. I'm too smart for that. I'm playing the role of a heel here, sir. So Fugazi was always just a little bit too regimented to me. Does that make sense?
Sure.
Now, what you've been able to do with this is show how a very regimented band was able to connect with thousands of other bands and make connections around the globe, literally around the globe, in ways that most anyone else couldn't and haven't.
Yeah.
Why? This was your thesis for school, is that correct?
Yeah, at MICA in Baltimore.
Why make Fugazi the thesis for a master's?
Yeah. Well, so this program was oriented to visual design as information visualization program. So the whole concept of this program is relatively new, is to leverage design to tell stories visually. Mm-hmm. And so it's pretty interdisciplinary, involves design, statistics, a little bit of journalism, a little bit of programming, all mushed together to do these kinds of projects. So for me, I wanted to do a project that it was a story that I could tell authentically. And as someone who grew up in the DC area, going to shows, participating in the music scene, I had a kind of a baseline knowledge to be able to dive into a project like this. And
yeah, I don't know if it's part of your mission statement, but one of your first times seeing Fugazi was one, I think, their last show.
Yeah, I was 17, got to see them at Fort Reno in 2002. Yeah. I wanted to, I felt like there was a way to tell a story about punk in DC and how punk in DC feels different from other punk scenes in other cities. There's this sort of strain of social activism and, I don't know, just community connection to the city itself that was my experience growing up here, that when I go to other towns and see what shows are like there, they don't have that in the same way. And I wanted to tell this larger story, but it's really hard to find data on, for example, what are all the benefit shows that happened that Positive Force hosted or something like that. You know, the only records that exist on that are actually over at the DC Punk Archive that the DC Library hosts.
But that's also weird.
Yeah.
For you guys that are from here, that's normal to you. That's not normal. There's not a Chicago Punk Rock Archive at the Chicago Public Library, to my knowledge. I don't think Denver has that. But yeah, DC definitely has that.
Yeah, you're right. That's something that's unique to DC, that would be a totally normal thing, that there's people at the library who understand that this is part of the cultural legacy and heritage of the city. And so, you know, I went over to the punk archive at the I think it was the Georgetown branch of the library. When I started this project, I had kind of a broader scope, and I was trying to generally look at what they had. Basically, all that information is in the what they call the Mark Anderson collection, which is everything that came out of Mark Anderson's basement.
For the listener at home, Mark Anderson is?
He is the guy who runs Positive Force, who's like a punk activism group that hosts benefit shows.
In addition to Positive Force, he also runs... I'm not quizzing you, I apologize. I'm trying to throw it to you. We Are Family.
He runs We Are Family that does grocery deliveries for elderly residents in the area. And he also wrote the book on punk. He wrote the Dance of Days book, which is the history of the DC punk scene. So anyway...
You could also see Mark Anderson whenever the Foo Fighters play in town, because Dave Grohl always invites him and he shows up and then he tables for about a half an hour and then leaves. Because he's got other stuff to do, like... He might be the most punk rock motherfucker of all time.
Yeah, where he's busiest guy in DC.
He's so tired. He's got to be so tired all the time. He takes no acclaim or money, and he makes sure like everything he attends is it's the exact same thing as Fugazi. It's either free or $5 or less, and it's all ages, and everyone's invited, and that's how it is.
Yeah. So he basically donated his boxes of junk to the DC Punk Archive, and it's literally half of the collection are just boxes and boxes and boxes and boxes that no one's cataloged or gone through yet. And so I needed to narrow the scope a bit, and then I realized Fugazi's been documenting everything they've done the entire time, and they put up this live series, this archive of every live show they've played. They actually have this pretty detailed record of what their tenure as a band was like.
Which, once again, not the normal punk rock scene. The biggest band in every other scene other than DC is not documenting everything. The biggest band out of New York is probably the Ramones. They hated each other.
Right.
Famously. Not a fan of each other. L.A., most of them killed each other. In Chicago, Naked Ray Gun. No, most people outside of that city don't know who they are. So, like, yeah, this is very unique to D.C.
Right. The impetus behind the live series, weirdly enough, this is what Ian told me. It stemmed from like when he was a kid and he loved Jimi Hendrix, and there was this tape trading community around Jimi Hendrix live shows. And you know, the solos might be different at this one like festival show, and the people are like, oh, did you hear like, you know, Hey Joe at this show, whatever. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know if he thought that people would care about his band in the same way in the future, but they just started recording every show they played. So they had all this stuff on this website, and I was like, yeah, I could just scrape data off of the webpage and turn it into a project. Like, I'd narrow the scope to just one band and use that band as a lens to kind of get a picture of the broader scene.
I'm going to ask you a very broad question because you just mentioned the broader scene. Is what you're doing art?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, cool. I agree. Okay. but your art is different than a painting. Your art is different than a collage, even though it's sort of a mixture between everything. Yeah. Your art is data-driven.
Right.
So, how would you classify yourself if you're filling out your taxes?
Well, it's a good question. Well, we're not making money off of this exhibit just yet. So
wait,
so,
you're telling me that the Fugazi lover, of course.
So, I mean, we're treating the show more like a museum exhibit, right?
Okay.
So it's you think about the way you might go to not even an art museum at the Smithsonian. I'm thinking like the Natural History Museum, where you have your wall panel that has like the display text explaining about the Triceratops or whatever it might be. And so like I designed this in such a way that someone can go to the exhibit knowing nothing about the band and have enough context to kind of get a flavor and get the story. But yeah, it was, you know, we don't have any, I never expected someone to try to buy these giant 6-foot panels off the wall and hang it at their house. They're not art pieces in the same way that someone might buy a painting.
Has anyone offered to buy it?
No, that has not happened
yet. That's going to happen.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised if the beautiful Line Hotel in Adams Morgan purchased the Fugazi connection tree. Jamal, am I crazy on saying that?
I don't think it's a stretch, especially it's like their community.
You know
what I'm saying?
Right. They'll put it downstairs in the Adams Morgan Community Center.
That would be smart.
Yeah.
Right. Well, so the main like output that is for sale is the initial format of the project was a fanzine, was a newsprint zine.
I want to make it clear that when he's saying fanzine, it's not the fanzine you're thinking of, because this thing is incredibly well designed. I made a ton of zines. They never looked like yours.
Well, I got mine professionally printed. I did not photocopy it.
Yeah, it's not real.
But
I mean, it's technically a zine, but like, dude, this is high quality stuff. You did a really good job.
Thanks. Yeah, well, in my basement, I have a few file folders of zines that I collected or bought over the course of like high school, college, etc. There's a few in there that are like the larger, you know, print run 5,000, 10,000 copy print run zines that were operating more like little magazines.
Sure.
And they got those printed on newsprint because it's so much cheaper.
Sure.
So that's sort of the tradition that I was like, okay, you know, it's sort of still a fanzine, but mine does fold out to giant newspaper size, yeah, or whatever.
It's gorgeous.
But the idea was, it's, you know, it seeing it, there's two ways to see it, right? You can come to the gallery, to the exhibit, and see it in person, nice and big, or you can pick up the zine and take it home with you and just obsess over it, all the details, and leaf through it in that way. So
I might be the one guy that likes the side projects, or not side projects, sorry, the future projects of the members of Fugazi than the band Fugazi.
Okay.
So yeah, when I look at your thing, I'm like, I kind of like the Evens more.
Sure.
Like, I definitely like Death Fix the most. I'm probably the minority.
I mean, you know, different strokes. The cool thing about all those musicians is, to me, they are musicians first, not, you know, they also are community members and activists. And Ian, running Discord Records, really at this point, he's an archivist more than anything else. He's got so much stuff over at Discord House. But they all have been so prolific, and their bands, both before and after Fugazi, like, there's a lot of really interesting stuff there. And so on the family tree, you know, infographic that you can see, the cool thing about it staying up that way was how much those guys like continue to really like each other and want to play music together. And so two of the members, Brendan the drummer and Guy, who's the other guitarist and singer, mostly predating Fugazi, they played in so many bands together. There's like, you know, 7 or 8 bands on that list that were just, they just kept starting projects together.
Well, yeah, you can see them this weekend on Friday opening up for XX.
Yeah, so that's Brendan and Joe.
Yeah.
So Joe Lally, the bassist, and he's in a new project with Brendan. It's not so new at this point, but yeah. So they're still playing music together. But yeah, Fugazi's not a band for everyone. I think they would be the first to admit that, for sure.
I like those, mem. I like what that did, and what your exhibit is making me do is the thing that Fugazi never made me do. This sounds like I don't like the band. That's not true. It makes me want to play, sure, which I think is a wonderful, wonderful thing. And you play as well.
Yeah.
And another piece that you've done that's not related to this, I mean, it's somewhat related to this, but it's not part of this exhibit, is you made a wonderful infographic. And I think the origin of it is saying, like, when I was 13 to 18, I was in a bunch of bands. This is how you record a demo, essentially.
Yeah, yeah.
That thing, that little one sheet you've made, is so incredibly useful. And I wish I had that so much when I was 16, because you break it down in a super simple way. Now, Jamal, how old were you when you recorded your first piece of music?
I actually was like 10 years old.
10 years old. So when you were 10,
it was on like a tape recorder.
You were on a tape recorder.
Yeah.
If I gave you this gear today, what you're using now, would you know how to use it as a 10-year-old?
As a 10-year-old, no way. No way.
Now this little...
But I think there probably are definitely like 10-year-olds that maybe started at like 8. That,
oh, for sure.
Which, you know how simple stuff is now.
Absolutely.
They could adapt.
You know, the kids these days with the internet, they can do everything.
And yeah, for sure. What you've done with this wonderful little infographic is like you've breaking it down. Like, this is where to put the microphone for the guitar once you get the tone you want. And this is how it goes into the board. This is the bass. This is the keys. This is the vocals. It's very cute, basic. And that is equally inspiring to me.
Cool. Yeah, so that was actually for a really interesting class. It was not a design class. The class was on human cognition and perception. And so the final project for the class was, it's like we went deep into what the brain is able to kind of parse and comprehend at various ages, various like levels of education, et cetera. And so if you're doing design work for elementary school kids versus adults versus someone who's elderly whose vision might be impaired, you make very different design choices. And so this class was like, the final assignment was very open-ended, but it had to be driven by, you know, picking a target audience. And for me, it was like someone who's like high school age.
Yeah.
And speaking directly, you know, making design choices that would speak directly to them and be accessible. So,
which leads to this question. Who is this for? Who's the Fugazi exhibit for?
So I think it has a DC audience first, right?
Okay.
I really wanted it to be something that hometown folks could go to the exhibit and... you know, I think the map of DC that I put together about where they played is super interesting context for like how DC has changed from the 80s and the 90s to today. So yeah, so it's for DC folks first. I think it's for music fans broadly beyond that. And what's been interesting about this project is it's sort of taken a life of its own. It's gotten around there on the internet a little bit. So I've heard from different, you know, audiences I didn't expect to really care about the exhibit. So I've actually gotten a lot of emails from academics, people that are in digital humanities, ethnomusicology, stuff like that. People who mainly just write papers, who are used to writing essays. And it sort of sparked ideas or you know, source of inspiration for ways to talk about or do humanities projects in a visual way and not purely like having to write these like 50-page essays or whatever.
We're going to ask a few more questions and then wrap up if that's okay with
you. Sure.
Your dream jukebox, you get to pick one album that goes on that jukebox. It has to be a real album. It can't be a personal mixtape, but it can be a soundtrack. It has to be something that I could buy in a store.
Yeah.
What is the LP that you're putting on your dream jukebox? This is a jukebox in a bar, and it's a bar you like. Think The Raven. I'm assuming you like The Raven.
So I'm going to end up there, and I have to, you know, subject my friends to having to listen to this album over and over and over again. Yeah, so probably it's not going to be a punk record, even though I listen to tons of punk records. I don't know. I feel like, especially at a bar, trying to get people pumped up a little bit, something like Public Enemy, Fear of a Black Planet, I feel like could be an album that you can just like, there's, you know, 18 tracks or whatever it is, you know, they're like one for a night, like you can keep revisiting it and like still get stoked on that album.
What is the one song that you would play over and over again?
Oh, man. I don't remember if it's on that album or Nation of Millions. I can't remember which album it's on, but that song, 911 is a joke.
Yeah.
Keep coming back to that one.
Okay. What could the city be doing? What could the District of Columbia be doing to make it a better place for artists?
That's a good question. That's a very broad question.
It is.
There's actually a forum on that topic earlier this week or last week that Matt Cohen at the City Paper did a little bit of reporting from, but it was like a forum that some council members were at that was specifically on that topic. I haven't actually read his reporting from there to tell you what they talked about.
As an artist, I want to know what you think.
Yeah. I mean, so thinking back to what the last few years have been like in DC, it's like the shuttering of venues and spaces that feel like fully independent, like you can do anything there and have really out there art events there. The shuttering of spaces has been like the biggest blow. And so the one that like the space that I loved going to that I played at, that when it closed down, I don't feel like a space has popped up to take its place, was Union Arts, which was in Northeast DC. It's near the Union Market area. Whenever spaces like that do pop up, even if they're unsanctioned, once they have been around for even just a year or two, like they have enough legitimacy because of the role they play in the art scene that... So let me back up. So I feel like other cities, when there's unsanctioned art spaces that have been around for 15 or 20 or 30 years, they then at that point get enough legitimacy that cities will basically take extreme proactive measures to protect them and sanction them, right? Or you know, say, oh, okay, I don't know, like Gilman, like 953 Gilman Street in San Francisco, stuff like that. Like they're accepted by the city as, oh, this is like part of our cultural history, this venue needs to be protected, right? But I don't think you can wait 20, 30 years. Like, I think venues that are active or spaces that are active doing interesting arts now that only have like a lifespan of a year or two, like after a couple years of running and actually being successful and fostering really cool art projects, whether it's music, you know, visual theater, whatever, like the city should find ways to protect them and find pathways to make them go from an unsanctioned space over towards a space that maybe, you know, is passing all, you know.
So maybe like a city liaison somewhere between like the ANC board or something like that and the venue to like help them out.
Yeah. Some pathway to go from a basically just like under the radar illegal space to an art space that's not going to get shut down by the fire department for fire code violations.
Yeah.
Doesn't have to worry about being like converted to luxury hotels very quickly. So I don't know how that happens, but yeah, protecting DIY spaces that good art can happen in, to me, is the most important thing.
Final question. Why are you still in DC?
I don't know. So most of my friends have left or come back, or, you know, my core friend group in DC has changed over 5 or 6 or 7 times because it's such a transient city. But stayed for the music scene. I stayed for work. I work at my area of expertise outside of the stuff I do in the music scene. I do design work for nonprofits in the DC area, and I've basically been doing that out of college. You know, I'm not interested in doing design work for like real estate firms or for like pharmaceutical companies. And so being able to do design work for organizations I believe in, one of the few places there's actually a large enough client base to do that kind of design work is in the DC area.
Okay.
So it's partly work, and it's, I don't know, it feels like home.
Your exhibit runs through...
It's up for two more weekends. You can see it on Saturdays and Sundays, so it's up this coming weekend, and then it's the last day is May 19th.
And if people aren't able to go to that, they could still order the zine online?
Yeah, through my website, carneyclears.com.
And the name of the gallery is?
Lost Origins Gallery on Mount Pleasant Street.
And you should check it out if you have the time, or at least buy the zine. Thank you so much for doing this.
Yeah, no problem.
You could see Two Fourths of Fugazi this Friday opening up for XX at 9:30 Club.
Yeah, should be a great show. I'm going to be there.
I won't. I'll be at our Nat Geo event on Friday at the National Geographic Museum. You will be with your son, because that is the appropriate thing to do.
I will be being a father.
And then on Sunday, you're going to celebrate Mother's Day.
I'll be celebrating Mother's.
With music.
With music.
Yeah. At Eaton.
At Eaton Hotel.
There you go. Yeah. That's our weekend. We'll be back here next week. I won't be back pre-recording that show. We're going to be talking about art a lot this month. So I want to thank Carney for opening up those floodgates. And the next six shows will all be focused on art. So thanks for listening, everybody, and have a wonderful night.